Good morning. It's the time of year for New Year predictions. Today, Neil Milner considers how social psychologist Philip Tetlock says those predictions can be improved. We'll look at super forecasting this hour. Meanwhile, Tracy Willen is offering some predictions of her own for your hiring future. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Waikiki's New Year's Eve fireworks display is more than a day away, but the work is already underway for Fireworks by Gucci executive producer Tommy Likos. He'll tell us what it takes to put on an extravaganza. And art and nature's design merge in the work of Maui artist Jennifer Stevens. She'll talk about the inspiration for her unique collage.
It's Wednesday, December 30th. The conversation starts right after this news. Oh, well, to get you started on the eve of the eve. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. I'm still trying to figure out what that song was about.
Oh, good. Well, you keep figuring it out because a lot of people are trying to figure out the future, and that's the subject of several of our conversations this morning. Now, if you were offered the chance to see your future, would you take it? Well, many people would, and that's keeping a lot of psychics in business. But for the larger questions of humanity, predicting the future may have a much better chance with super forecasting. The work of social scientist and psychologist Philip Tetlock is based more in acute awareness than divination. Our resident social scientist and contributing editor Neil Milner has had a look, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
When we talk about, you know, predicting the future, that seems to connote an ability that some people may have to see things that others cannot. This seems to be just the same thing, but with a very, very different driver, acute awareness as opposed to any sort of divine inspiration. Would that be right?
Well, I think that's right, but the first thing to understand about Tetlock is not just that he finds that out, and we'll come back to that in a moment. It's also what he finds out through very thorough, long-standing research about who is good at predicting complicated economic events and political events, who's good at it and who's not good at it. The two surprising groups that are terrible at it are, first of all, pundits. That may not be so surprising. Jonathan Franzen, the novelist, calls them cherry-picking anecdotalists, which suggests why a lot of pundits aren't good. They look for evidence that supports their pre-existing point of view. The other group that's not good are experts. And experts tend not to be good because they tend to have a well-formulated point of view. When I mean not good, the studies show that they don't do any better than random, and that this research got a nickname of chimpanzees throwing at a dartboard. But what Tetlock found in this very thorough research is that although on average people don't do well, including experts and a bunch of other people, there's a certain group of people, the kind that you began to describe, that he calls super forecasters, who really have a kind of talent and a sense of investigation and humility that the average person or that most people don't have. And in fact, this kind of super forecasting method won the contest that the Defense Department sponsored to see who could predict the best.
But this goes beyond just the contest. This is from the Good Judgment Project that's been going on for a very long time. And looking at the people who populate that project, who seem to have above average IQs, although that's not the reason for their ability to do this, it's just they happen to have that. But the fact that they maintain this acute awareness of what's going on and they're able to synthesize it based on, you know, probabilities without any sort of emotional attachment to an outcome.
Yeah, that's right. Let's just walk through one example of how they might do it very quickly. If you looked at if you looked at the question of what is the likelihood, the effect of, let's say, the reduction of interest rates, or maybe you want to do it on the on where ISIS is going to be a year from now. The way super forecasters do it, and again, first of all, they're not professional super forecasters. They're not subject matter experts. The first thing that they do that sets them apart from anybody else is the willingness constantly to seek information on the issue. So they're constantly looking for more information. The second thing is that they're willing to, they're always aware of their biases, that is, and that makes them seek information from very diverse sources so they get around it. The third thing has to do with thinking in probabilities. They don't think in terms of certainty, uncertainty in a black and white sense. So what Tetlock says is that it's much more about state of mind and the way you think about information and inquiry than it is about any expertise. These people are smart people. They're not geniuses. And what sets them apart is this kind of way of thinking and willingness to work at looking at a lot of different information.
And that's a big part of it, because seeking opinions from diverse sources is not usually what most people do, and we've talked about that
sure.
many times based on the research that you've shown.
Well, most of what a super forecaster does is not what most people do, but you're right, you're absolutely right. Most people seek out information, and remember, this includes particularly people who are politically committed. They seek out information that supports their views. They have a very strong filter. They're not constantly looking for more information from diverse sources. And most of us don't think in probability, although it is interesting how sports analysis has become much more probability-oriented to some extent due to political forecasting. That you'll get a ESPN will say there's a 62% chance that UCLA will win this game or that kind of stuff. But our minds don't normally think that way. If you're at a party and you're talking about politics, and if I do this and I say, well, it seems to me you could say on the basis of my research or whatever, that there's a 70%, you know, they're going to go right away for another glass of wine. They're not going to listen to you. So what these people have, these super forecasters, are inclinations that are very different, totally opposite from this kind of political thinking that's very common in society that you talk about before.
And how does that sync with sort of, you know, artificial intelligence and the push that people have said, well, maybe this is based on algorithms?
Well, I don't think it's based on algorithms. I think in a formal sense, but in a sense, these people think that way, in the sense that they think probabilities, and if you want to think about how they operate in terms of algorithms, one of the things that they do, then we all think in terms of algorithms. We all have formulas in our heads. The difference for super forecasters is that they tend to be flexible about changing those algorithms. They tend to be willing to say, now, this new information would suggest that the formula I'm thinking about, the kind of projection view that I have, might be wrong, and so let's reassess it. So it isn't so much that they're thinking in a kind of, I don't know what you want to say, formal mathematical sense. It's the fact that they understand how to think in probability, but at the same time, they also know that the world shifts and that you have to keep looking.
Any work to compare this to what an AI might do with it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know enough about AI to say for sure. I suppose you can, you know, you can
I mean,
shove.
I'm thinking about, you know, Watson and the
yeah,
whole thing
right.
with Jeopardy,
well,
and that seemed to be very different from what you're talking
I
about
I think
here.
It is very different. I've never heard about artificial intelligence like Watson doing this kind of stuff. The way Watson works is that if you can get enough information in there, like for chess, they can deal with an enormous amount of variables. And, of course, they can digest more information than the human can. What I'm saying, there's a kind of judgmental, introspective process that's working here that I can't say for sure whether artificial intelligence can do this, but it's different.
And a lot of people may be very glad of that fact.
Well, okay.
Neil, thanks very much.
You're
for
welcome.
This and a Happy New Year.
Same to you, folks.
Contributing editor Neil Milner considers social science research and related matters in our biweekly segment, The Long View. He'll be back in a couple of weeks.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up, kicking off the new year with sound, fury, and spectacle. But first, your quiz.
As the number of tourists increases during the holidays, so do hotel reservations. And in this morning's backyard quiz, we're remembering one of Oahu's most distinctive hotels, a classic design from its time. Originally designed in 1964 by John Graham, the same architect who designed the Seattle Space Needle, this building was considered Hawaii's first high-rise luxury resort. Over the years, the Landmark Hotel's guests have included Presidents Gerald Ford and Lyndon Johnson, as well as entertainment stars Elvis Presley, Lucille Ball, and Dolly Parton. The hotel can be spotted during its multiple appearances on the dramatic opening sequences of the original Hawaii Five-O as it towers into the sky with the main character, Steve McGarrett, on the roof. Enough hints? Okay. Can you tell us the name of this Waikiki landmark? We'll be back with it in just a bit, but if you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the t-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Abel Coelho from the Ruined Map Dance Company. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Fireworks display packs a lot of excitement into a relatively short span of time, but those 15 minutes of spectacle reflect countless hours of planning and preparation. Somebody has to keep track of all the logistics, and this New Year's Eve in Waikiki, that responsibility falls to Tommy Likos and his team from Fireworks by Grucci. He's already up and on the job, and he's on the phone this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
You've got a lot of work ahead of you in the next 36 hours, don't you?
Well, we're just kind of wrapping up. Most of the work is already done. Now it's just a matter of loading the fireworks onto the barge.
What kind of preparation have you been doing?
Well, we start with the design of the show probably 6 months in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And then 90 days, we start applying for permits from the various organizations that control the fireworks in the island. So,
mm-hmm.
And then it starts to get wrapped up here, where we're renting trucks and getting the crew together and getting everybody onto the pier, and so it's busier and busier.
I bet. Well, I know that a lot of the big fireworks shows, including this one, Fireworks by Grucci, are products of family businesses. This is kind of a European family tradition, isn't it?
That's true. And Grucci, old Grandpa Grucci, brought the secret formulas over from Italy back in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's still a family-run organization.
And that seems to be a kind of an overarching thing that happens with a lot of fireworks shows, that their secrets kept down through generations. In this case, what, six generations of the Grucci family, huh?
Yeah, that's correct.
How did you get into this field?
Well, I started doing fireworks on the mainland on an amateur basis with the Pyrotechnic Guild International, and Grucci invited me to come to their school in New York. And they were having the show in Hawaii. I think this was in 2001. It was the premiere of the movie Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my show in Hawaii, and it's taken off since then.
It's always amazing to me when I see a fireworks show how precisely you can predict. I mean, you know what's going to happen and what the effects are and where everything is going to take place. And I'm just wondering what goes into all that.
Well, it's a matter of we know exactly how long it takes the shell from the time you fire it till the time the shell explodes in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, with our computers, we can program that down to a thousandth of a second. So when the bass drum hits, we can have a shell explode at exactly that same second.
All synced to the music through a very elaborate setup.
It is. But, you know, with the software nowadays, you can play the music, listen to the music, and then pick out the shells from your inventory that you think will fit in with that music. And with these programs, like I say, then you can time them exactly.
That's amazing. So you say on this beat I'd like a kind of a red star boom effect to happen, and that's what you get, huh?
That's correct, yes. So if we want a loud bang in this show Thursday night, you know, right at midnight, we're going to have, you'll see some shells going up into the air a little before midnight so that they explode right exactly at midnight.
Wow. The whole idea of being able to tell precisely when an explosion is going to take place from the time the projectile has been fired, is that a function of the amount of powder that you use? What are the variables that determine that?
Well, the way a shell works is there's a lift charge in the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and that is black powder. An electric match will fire off that black powder, and then when that black powder ignites, lifting the shell out of the mortar, it also ignites a time fuse inside the shell that burns through to the center, the part that explodes. So that time fuse burns at a very set rate, so that at a certain amount of seconds after the lift, then that center ignites and explodes the shell.
Because I've always wondered how you could be that. That makes sense because you know at each step of the way what the materials are and how long they take to burn. Right.
That's correct.
You've got the exact numbers for that because I've always amazed in the field of pyrotechnics when, you know, when again this is done by family businesses in the city where when you can demolish a building with a building on either side and have it just sort of fall straight down. That's all part of the science of pyrotechnics, isn't it?
Well, that's kind of more of the explosive side of it. We
mm-hmm.
we like to do the pyrotechnics. We've done like when they collapsed the sands in Las Vegas, we had a lot of fireworks that went off just before the implosion of the building.
Oh boy!
So. And then for more precise things, for like chases around stadiums, things we used in the Olympics,
mm-hmm.
we actually have an electronic fuse that is timed so that when the shell lifts off, it starts that electronic fuse. And that's when we really want it down to a thousandth of a second. When you see a chase go around a stadium where you know, the shells are going off one right after another very closely, then that's generally done electronically.
It really makes me wonder how you ever got this accomplished before the days of computers.
Well, my wife and I did the last hand-fired show over at the Marine Corps base probably 10 years ago,
uh-huh.
where it was just a matter of lighting those fuses with a flare, and Phil Grucci decided, you know, we want to be away from the explosion.
Yeah.
So he really pressed for more computer, more electric matches and things. So
I think that makes a lot of sense.
You could still get a fairly accurate show hand lighting.
But it's nice to have that extra layer of security, Tommy. So.
It certainly is.
Thanks very much for talking with us this morning. Have a great New Year's Eve.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
And Happy New Year.
Tommy Likos is the executive producer of Fireworks by Grucci, which is putting on the Waikiki Improvements Association's New Year's Eve Fireworks Extravaganza on Waikiki Beach.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll visit a garage where dozens of cars wait for their starring turn in Hollywood movies.
You could be almost anywhere. You pop a 49 car there, and it transforms the setting to the year of the car.
Lenny Schiller's Garage, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hear this New Year's Eve special Thursday afternoon at 5.
Throughout the year, you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for news, talk, information, and ideas. We've been there for you, and we count on you to be there for us. We gratefully acknowledge these contributing members for their generous station support: Nadine Light of Honolulu, Glenn Davies of Pahoa, and John Senior of Honolulu. Now it's your turn. Today, please pick up the phone and make your tax-deductible contribution to Hawaii Public Radio by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours, or go online and click Donate Now at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii and Ulupono Initiative.
The video showing the surprise wedding of a gay couple has now been viewed over 6.5 million times since its release on Monday, and that's good news for the Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau, which planned the whole thing. Can more happy couples be far behind? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, this is a happy story for today. First of all, thinking that they could get away with planning a surprise wedding, and we should say that one of the couple at least was in on it. But the way this whole thing developed and how it's positioning Hawaii as a gay wedding destination seems to be a time, something whose time has really come.
Well, in many ways, we were actually rather late to this important market. Many other communities that rely on tourism, Key West, Florida, New Orleans, San Francisco, really ahead of the curve on marketing to the gay and lesbian market, and they've reaped the benefits, lots of money. Well, now think about it. Now it's been 2 years since Hawaii has legalized gay marriage, 6 months since the Supreme Court made it legal across the country. So this is an important development for the HVCB, which, by the way, is contracted with the state to market Hawaii. So it's a big deal because it results in a lot of money. There is an estimate that at least $26 million has come in annually just from the LGBT market alone for Hawaii.
There was a lot of conversation about this, you know, years ago as we began to talk about gay marriage and what the possibilities were. Okay, so we're a little slow on the uptake, but having seen this now and the results, there's got to be a lot more money and a lot more attention behind it.
It's really a lovely video. You can see it on our website, Todd Simmons' article. It's about a six-minute clip, and not only is it just a wonderful love story between these two men, but also shows Hawaii in such a wonderful light. Alaska Airlines has helped out, and they helped fly in friends and family of this couple. The wedding was held here, and that certainly is bound to influence other couples to think about holding their weddings in Hawaii, which of course would benefit everybody. About 10% of our weddings every year are actually gay and lesbian weddings.
Have any sense of what those projections might be as more of this attention and a lot of more marketing is paid?
You know, it's still nascent here. We're still trying to figure it out, but clearly there has been impact just since Hawaii finally legalized gay marriage. And this is a group that likes to – that values travel. This is what the data tells us. They value that over other leisure expenditures. So this is clearly folks we ought to be reaching out to.
And apparently we will be doing more of that reaching in future. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, I can only imagine what sort of things that we can't yet predict are going to happen in the coming year, yeah?
So, Chris, do you have any predictions for 2016?
Well, are you going to finally make it to the moon this year? I know we've been talking about that.
Well, maybe virtually.
Virtually, I'll take that, sure.
Because I think... Well, you know, we're going to talk on the show about some of the things that our guests might predict for happening in 2016. Now, one of the things that I think is definitely going to happen is that, you know, the VR headsets, the AR glasses, those are all going to be featured at the upcoming CES. So I'm pretty sure that there's going to be simulations of traveling to places like the moon and Mars. So definitely on my agenda.
AR as in, what is that, alternate reality?
Augmented reality.
Augmented reality.
Yeah. And, of course, VR is virtual reality.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we'll also explore, you know, some of the tech scene happenings here in Hawaii. What's on the sort of tech agenda? What's happening with some of our startups and accelerators? And we might delve into what might be happening at the legislature. Are there any tech bills that we ought to be paying attention to? And those kinds of things. So... It'll be a fun sort of recap of 2015 and definitely looking forward to 2016.
Well, this is a pretty lively community that you folks have, and it seems to be getting lively every year, Bert.
Well, you know, I think the tech community has definitely acknowledged our channel here at Hawaii Public Radio, so that's really a good thing, and we've definitely got a listenership, so... you know, we've got Mele James coming on and Ian Kitajima, and they're both very prominent in our tech community, so we'd love to hear what they have to say.
Well, we'll look forward to it. Thanks, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Support for today's programming comes from the Outlets of Maui, Lahaina. With more than 30 name brands, including Tommy Hilfiger, Michael Kors, Gap, and Guess. Open New Year's Eve, 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., and New Year's Day, 9:30 a.m. to 10 p.m.
We started the morning talking about the art and science of predictions, but maybe you already know that in 2016, it'll be the year that you need to find a new job. Thought leader and writer Tracy Weiland has some help. Her 2016 hiring predictions are out now, as is her latest book, Employed for Life, 21st Century Career Trends. She joins us now by phone. Good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, good morning, Beth Ann.
The first thing that's on the list, as many of us have been observing for a while now, are certain things that will cater to seniors to keep them not only aging in place, but to deliver the services that they're going to need. What exactly do you see as we move into this year that might be a little bit different from what we've talked about in past?
Well, you know, Beth Ann, we've hit a tipping point in North America. We are an aging society. It is the senior moment, so to speak, and one out of three Americans is now 50 or older. In fact, economists project that aging is very big business. It's a $7.1 trillion business globally. So with over 100 million residents in the United States over the age of 50, that opens up a lot of job and future job creation.
So we're not just talking about caregiving and healthcare-oriented things, but real fun things and enjoyable things that are geared to people who aren't toting around kids.
Sure. When you think about it, you know, first the basics is, you know, people need places to live. And as we get older, we have different ways of we want to spend our lifestyle. We might want to join adult communities. We might want to, you know, some of us might go to retirement homes. Some of us might want to retire at home. And all of this requires people to service these different kinds of needs. But we also have a lot more time on our hands. We're not working anymore, and so we'd like to spend our time. And I think our baby boomers have redefined retirement and how they spend their time. As you mentioned, having more fun. They're traveling more than when they were employed and spending more. And they're even, you know, increasing the adoption of pets, which we had always viewed as a millennial type of trend. So they're filling the empty nest with things that they really enjoy and bringing that through their senior years.
When you say that, you know, we're traveling more, does that mean that we can expect to see a lot more of, you know, not just packages, but of services when we travel that are geared to people who are, you know, over the age of 50 or 65?
Sure. So travel, for example, is projected to grow over 36% over the next 10 years just from retirees and boomers traveling more when they retire. 8 million more domestically and 4 million more overseas. But if you think about the ripple effect, that requires transportation, airlines, trains, cruise liners, hospitality services, hotels, restaurants, tourism. Even there's a whole host of franchises that are emerging just to service the retired traveling community. And so if you are looking for a way to either transition your career or look for new jobs, I think this whole area of aging is a new platform where you can look for, at any age, different kinds of jobs.
Let's move on a bit, in the interest of time, because we talk a lot about security, and you write a lot about technology. What do you see coming at us this next year that might change a little bit some of your projections from last year?
Yeah, yes. And I say that, sadly, security is a safe bet. And last year I talked a lot about cybersecurity and the need for us to have ethical hackers because it is an area that's growing in job creation 12 times faster than the overall job market. But if you listen to the news, you know that every day there's a headline on terrorism. So this whole idea of counterterrorism is creating a lot of jobs. In fact, it's a $61 billion market by 2024. New York, for example, just started a squad in 2015 of 100 people. They expect to grow to 500 people to really protect the city, and I think that will continue to grow in many cities around the U.S. and overseas as well. So there's a lot of jobs that will be created just through security needs.
How about other technology needs? I'm talking about artificial intelligence, or as we've been hearing a great deal about, immersive technologies and having a little fun in virtual reality.
Sure. So artificial intelligence is a big area for investment. If you think about your Siri on your iPhone, she's going to get smarter and smarter, and your toys will talk back to you and even answer intelligent questions. So I think artificial intelligence will open up a lot of jobs, not only on the software side, but also in consulting, marketing, and sales. Immersive technologies is a hot area. It's a $150 billion market. And actually, there's people who are making money in this whole new area of called esports, where we actually watch people either on a YouTube or Twitch playing immersive games or a whole competitive format. In fact, I was just in Las Vegas, and this esports will be probably a gambling mechanism, not only a place for people to go and watch teams combat other teams in well-known immersive sports.
For Christmas season, a lot of kids might have received drones. That's the toy version. But what about the greater market for drone use?
Yeah, so drones is about an $82 billion market that is expected to create about 100,000 jobs across the U.S. over the next 10 years. And I think a lot of us think of it as a toy. But the cost of drone manufacturing has reduced. People use it for weather, surveillance, disaster recovery, and military. And Amazon is pushing for commercial use so that they can deliver packages in under 10 minutes. The opportunities there is for operators and pilots. Drone pilots, trainers, people understand the technology and the robotics. So the drones is something that will be expected to hit many areas and open up jobs.
Let's switch away from that for a second and take a look at people who might not be involved necessarily with technology or senior services in some sort of way. When you look at what's happening in the world of blue-collar work, what do you see?
So, you know, we always need these services. They're not going away. By 2017, an estimated 2.5 million new middle-skill jobs are expected to be added to the workforce. These are our plumbers, our carpenters, electricians, air conditioning. But if you look at a broader picture, it's infrastructure. And infrastructure will continue to grow and require experienced and skilled people. And these are where some of the higher paying jobs, 50,000 or up a year. And that's, you know, our refineries, our ports, our air, you know, our power supplies, trains, you know, anything that is large infrastructure. These will not only continue to grow and improve, but they also will require more skilled and experienced people. So if you haven't found a job or pursued college, I would look to the trades and skilled work as well.
Then there are those who really are trying to create some balance between work and the rest of their lives, people who would prefer to be their own bosses, who have a product or a service that they uniquely deliver. What do you see for micropreneurs as we look at 2016?
Yes. In fact, in the U.S., the projection was that 50% of the population was either a micropreneur, which is a person who has their own sustenance, so to speak, in employment, or in a small business. And so micropreneurs and microbusiness is about half of our nation's jobs, and that will continue to grow. Our millennials have really embraced this concept. Many millennials have said that they just don't want to be on the corporate treadmill. They want to be able to manage their own time and their income and have that work-life balance, but also make money. And it can be everything from an Uber driver to renting out a room through Airbnb to selling a craft on Etsy, or, you know, logoed items and business cards on Zazzle, or something like I do, just an independent researcher. So this whole area is growing, and it is now, you know, becoming the new norm for employment, not the fallback if you didn't work in a corporation. So I would expect that, given the fact that we can have crowdfunding and access to finances as well as digital platforms that we can participate in, I would see a lot more of that in 2016.
Being your own boss can also mean buying a business or perhaps buying a franchise. And there are franchises of all different stripes all over the place. Any particular one that you see where there might be more opportunities this year than last?
Yeah, yes, I do. And I think franchising is for people like myself who maybe don't have a creative idea on a startup but want to own their own business. So in the franchise concept, you can buy into a business anywhere for as little as $500 all the way up to a McDonald's. The big hot areas is of course, health and wellness, a lot of catering to the senior communities, as well as food franchises and outsourced services. So it's the cleaning services, the delivery services, the food services. So you can look in, actually, Entrepreneur Magazine just came out with, in 2016, their whole encyclopedia, pretty much. They dedicated a whole issue to franchises, and you can look and see by price point and by category what makes sense.
Tracy, I wish we had more time to explore a few more things, but we have to say goodbye for the moment and wish you a happy new year, and we'll see about your predictions the next time we talk.
Happy New Year.
Dr. Tracy Weiland speaks and writes on the impact of technology on society, work, and careers. She's been a scholar at Stanford University and held leadership positions at Apple, HP, and Cisco Systems. She's the author of 11 books and was an adjunct professor for 15 years teaching business and women's topics. Her latest book is Employed for Life, 21st Century Career Trends.
During the first half of the show, we asked if you knew the name of the landmark hotel known for its array of famous guests from the worlds of politics and entertainment, as well as its many television appearances. The building design is one of its greatest identifiers. Its unusual three-winged Y shape, embedded with tiles of light turquoise blue, helps keep people easily located on the streets and shore of Waikiki. It was Hawaii's first hotel that boasted a clear glass elevator, one of the highest in the world at the time it was constructed. If your guess for our quiz was the Ilikai Hotel, you're right.
And so was Edgar Frame from Kailua Kona, who called in to say that he remembers when the Ilikai first opened and his parents brought him to the hotel and he got to meet the developer, Chin Ho.
All right. That's 8:47. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, announcing their annual Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations, February 1st through 4th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
No artist can match the intricacy of nature's designs, but all can be inspired by it. And some, like Maui artist Jennifer Stevens, have found ways to merge their designs with the ones nature provides, leading to a result that's greater than the sum of its parts. Jennifer works in collage and mixed media, among others, to create images that could only come from an unfettered imagination. She's on the line from her studio. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me on the show today.
My pleasure. The work that first drew me to your stuff, Jennifer, is your insects.
Oh yeah, they're fun little critters, those guys.
They are. They're spectacular, and the way how should we describe these insect things? You've taken real insects and sort of woven a design in and around them, yeah?
Yeah, so I do them in Photoshop, and I use all different types of imagery of textures and illustrations and layers. And I kind of create almost like a little dissection chart that maybe a scientist would make, but I make them a little more whimsical and fun.
Yes, a couple of them have bowler hats, which I think has got to be a a reference to Magritte, yeah?
Yeah, I definitely like to give them little characters as I'm building them. And sometimes the characters come out as I'm making them. Sometimes I have an idea that I just run with, and they all just seem to work out.
So when you say you do them in Photoshop, is that you start with like a photograph of one of these bugs? Or?
Yeah. So I start with photographs, and then I kind of manipulate all the photographs and, you know, add things to them. So there's like, you know, in each piece there's hundreds of layers, and I kind of sort of build them up and then break them back down and build them up again.
Yeah, because most of the times when you see designs done in Photoshop, it's maybe four or five layers. It looks as if you've really copied something with easily dozens of layers, it looks like.
Yeah, using you know, like vintage maps and, you know, text and old schematics and things like that. I just try and give it sort of like a, you know, a vintage sort of rustic look, like it's been around forever.
Well, that's kind of, what was the source of that inspiration? What got you going on that particular pathway?
You know, I did a series previously called Curiosities, and it was pretty well received. Fun little critters, you know, little oddities like fish riding, you know, little birds riding bikes on top of fish and stuff. And and I had done all types of little critters, and I thought, what could I do next? And I'm kind of obsessed with tiny things. So I thought, well, what's more tiny and amazing than bugs? Uh-huh. And, you know, just looking at all the different beetles and bugs out there, they're just so intricate and beautiful, and they were just inspiring. So as I started working with them, I started kind of creating these little worlds around them that you could kind of escape into, you know?
Yeah, and they look very, to the degree to which a bug can look at home, they look very much at home in their little world, yeah?
Yeah, their little wacky world.
And you've also got on the surfaces of them, you've created a really a lovely kind of iridescence, and I'm wondering how you get that effect, because that cannot be easy to reproduce.
Well, a lot of them have that natural iridescence to them. You know, I was kind of choosing bugs that did have these amazing colors that only nature could make. You know, and I'm sure it could be duplicated, but nature's, you know, the perfect artist. So,
yeah.
So, you know, some of that stuff is just natural. And then I kind of add some little layers on top of it to kind of, you know, bring in the man-made portion of it.
Well, as you say, Jennifer, and that was the thing that really got me looking at your work, is, as you say, nature is the perfect artist. And it can be, I don't know, it can be sort of intimidating, can it, to be trying to emulate what nature creates.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I definitely am not trying to copy it. I'm kind of, you know, just putting my own little spin on it and building fun little characters on, you know, out of what, you know, giving little personalities to them. That's sort of the fun, whimsical side of it that I love doing.
Sure. I mean, nature can do many things, but it can't put a bowler hat on a moth, for example.
Nope.
So that's where you come in. Well, that's where the artist as sort of deity unto herself comes in, right? There's anything goes, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
In the curiosities that you've done, I see a real influence of the surrealists. Is that an accurate perception?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
You know, Dali and Magritte and those guys.
Yeah, I would say, that was, you know, growing up here on Maui back in the day with no internet, we weren't really exposed to a lot of the art that people can see now. And so we kind of just had the greats to look at. And I remember, you know, Dali and Edvard Munch and kind of the more odd artists I was really attracted to, because my art wasn't very mainstream, you know, it was a little off.
Well, what a lot of those artists started doing in mid 20th century was kind of this direct window to their unconscious almost.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how it works for you? Do you just sort of let your mind go and put in whatever, almost like a dreamlike image comes in?
I would say kind of like that. I have very vivid dreams, and I also like to kind of create these sort of fantasy worlds that I can escape into, and the viewer can kind of escape into as well, and you know, create their own little interpretation of it. That's what I find really interesting. I'll have my own story behind it. And then I'll, you know, if it's in a show, someone will stand there and kind of tell me what they see. And that to me is always really fascinating, to hear what other people see in the piece.
Because it doesn't have to be what you intended, as long as they get something out of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I actually sometimes am more impressed by what other people see than what I've originally, you know, had in mind for it. I'm always like, wow, that's amazing.
I think that's a great thing to be able to do, Jennifer. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Jennifer J. Stevens was raised on the island of Maui and studied art at H.P. Baldwin High School under the tutelage of instructor Janet Sato in the AP Art Program. She operates a gallery, Unique Art Hawaii, and is the founder of Create Magazine. We'll be right back.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
The news can sometimes be overwhelming.
Blanc said France was under
a mass shooting in San Bernardino.
A police officer killing a child.
More than 2 degrees Celsius above.
Total and complete shutdown of Muslims.
Syrian refugees here being put under a magnifying glass.
All Things Considered is here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every afternoon.
Weekdays from noon to 2.
It's the prediction season, isn't it, Beth Ann, at the end of the year? Prediction and looking back season.
Well, this is true. It's sort of Janus-like, standing on that, you know, that point where you can see everything behind you and a little bit glimpsing of what's happening or you think will happen coming up. But I really enjoyed talking to Neil Milner this morning about the work of Philip Tetlock and the idea that this is not something that's coming from a divine source, but really people who are open to what's really happening and being able to synthesize that well, not based on any sort of emotional pull or draw to a particular conclusion, but really seeing what's there and having the ability to assign a probability to whatever outcome is part of the question.
Yeah, and as Neil says, we're all prone to making predictions based on what we want to happen, which of course does not is the enemy of accuracy. Yeah?
And very often the business of psychics.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, that's going to do it for us. And we will predict that we will be back with you tomorrow for a New Year's Eve look at a few conversations. And we're going to be talking about one that we haven't talked about for a while. As we heard yesterday, Guinea has been declared Ebola-free. Researchers are already working on what happens next time. Up tomorrow, we're going to take a look with one of them. And also, Gary Hooser is going to join us to give us a preview of the Food Justice Summit.
And there's a Kauai celebration of Makahiki season. Meanwhile, if you have something to say about what you hear on the show, you can make your comments to us on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want to pick up another one or just a part of it, you can find it all on the HPR2 archive. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HPR2.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation. See you then.